Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the SITREP podcast from BFBS. For months, the front lines of the Ukraine war have been largely static since the country's counteroffensive petered out. But that doesn't mean the fighting has ever stopped. And now there are signs the next big push is coming from Moscow's forces. So we get a close-up account from one of the most contested areas of recent months. Tom Much has been reporting from Ukraine for Byline Times since before the war began. He's just visited Ukrainian troops at the front line to get an insight into what's happening, the mood among the soldiers, and whether they're ready for what Russia has planned. Tom, really good to speak to you. Thank you for your time. You have recently been with Ukrainian troops close to the front line. Where were you and what did you see and experience?
So I was slightly east of the city of Kupiansk. That's in the Kharkiv region, north of Donbass, where a lot of the fighting takes place. It's actually a region that Ukrainians recaptured from the Russians back in September of 2022. And the Russians have been trying to push back and take that ground back. So, you know, they've been trying to go back and forth. The Russians haven't made that much progress there, thankfully. And one thing I was quite surprised to see was that the Ukrainian troops, they were just a little bit more upbeat than I expected, especially from my other experiences working in Donbass.
And why was that, do you think?
So there's a number of reasons. One is that it seems the positions they're holding there are just a little bit more defensible. So they have the higher ground. The city of Kupiansk basically sits on a hill, so they can overlook the entire area. They can position artillery there and basically fire it either from or next to the city down below. They have the Oskil River, which is a good natural barrier that the Russians have been unable to get past. And not just that, it seems that the Ukrainian command there sort of have everything together reasonably well, all right? Like, there are ammunition shortages, sure, but it does seem that when the troops really need ammunition, they can get it. It also appears that a lot of the shortages of ammunition, the Ukrainians have managed to not entirely make up, but compensate slightly for with the use of drones, whether that's the Vampire drone that we saw them use. Basically, it's a form of gardening drone. You stick a bunch of grenades to the underside of it, you fly it over a Russian trench and you just drop it on them, or with the use of sort of FPV drones, which you know you can strap a few explosives to and fly it right into a trench or a tank or an armored vehicle or a group of infantry and do real damage that way.
And how effective are they proving?
So they're pretty effective, but the problem is they're more effective in terms of stopping attacks than they are actually in terms of supporting. Because one of the things is with drones, you can basically see them coming. The advantages that artillery has over drones is once the time to target, you fire a shell, a couple of seconds, the shell is there, it hits, it causes a huge explosive impact. Drones, if infantry are in trenches, they can basically dive into the trenches and the dugouts and wait for the drone to, you know, then counter the drone with electronic warfare, wait for it to run out of, you know, break the connection with the controller, wait for it to run out of its batteries or whatever. So what that means is it's very, very hard to use drones to support an infantry advance. So the Ukrainians can use this technology for the moment to hold the line. And I think this is one of the reasons that, for instance, after we saw the Ukrainians lose Avdiivka, there wasn't a wider collapse of the front lines either there or either in that region or elsewhere in the region. However, if the Ukrainians are ever going to undertake another counteroffensive, they are going to need a lot of artillery shells and a lot of sort of, you know, high-tech rocket launchers that can strike behind the front lines and stuff like that.
And is it possible to compare the fighting you've just seen with what you've seen elsewhere and before?
So, sure. I mean, I just to be clear, is that the Ukrainian army, you know, they're not the most restrictive army in the world, but they basically see what they want you to see. You're never there for long. It's rare to be able to be there for more than, say, 5 to 6 hours at a time. So it's hard to get sort of a view into the day-to-day life or the day-to-day sort of back and forths. I would say I was in the Donbass. The last embed I did was about last October in the Donbass. And I do remember that the soldiers there, they were more depressed. They looked more exhausted. They had been fighting around Bakhmut, and they'd been fighting around Bakhmut, many of them generally, for about a year. And they had sort of lost it. This was when the counteroffensive was coming to an end. And I think that was the moment when the Ukrainians were realizing that this is if they ever win this war, it's going to be a very long, slow, protracted struggle, and that the Russians are not going to collapse. Whereas here, I hope it almost doesn't sound too flippant. I felt like the soldiers had sort of accepted the fate. They're like, look, we've been here. We're going to be here for a long time. I remember one of the commanders. I'm like, oh, so you've been fighting since the start of the war? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, when was that? When did you join up? He's like, oh, it started in 2014. So he started back in the war in Donbass. He'd been there literally for 10 years. And he was, I wouldn't call him the happiest looking bloke, but he sort of said he was still in total command of himself and his troops and his faculties. And I was like, these are just men for whom this now is their job, is their lives, and they're going to perform it to the best of their abilities.
And from where we are far away, what we hear from our sources and see from some of the open source intelligence on Moscow's actions creates a big picture suggesting a new Russian push is imminent, maybe underway. Does your close-up experience show any signs that might back or contradict that?
So one thing that we did hear in Kupiansk when we spoke to some of the people who were sort of Ukrainian, slightly higher ranking, like in the officer command, is that they were saying, look, the Russians have kept a lot of troops and armored vehicles in reserve here. Bear in mind, this trip was about 3 weeks ago now. So they were saying effectively, you know, we think that they're getting ready for a much bigger push. Now, the thing is that the weather in Ukraine over the last month or so hasn't been great. You know, the grounds are muddy, but we're just getting to the season now where the grounds are firming out and hardening, and that if you wanted to make any mechanized push, you really could. So, you know, we know that the Russians have been keeping a lot of, soldiers and vehicles in reserve. We know the Ukrainians have spent the last couple of months sort of digging trenches and laying down barbed wire and dragon's teeth and what have you, as if their lives depend on it, which I guess they do. And so everyone is expecting that over about the next month or so, we might not see, you know, a huge Russian offensive on all parts of the front, but we're probably at the very, very least going to see a new wave of localized offensives.
And where do you think that would be? Would it be Kupiansk?
Kupiansk makes the most sense for them. One, it's got there's sort of a symbolic significance to it because it was lost by the Russians rather in sort of humiliating fashion back in September 2022. They would like to recapture it to recover some of the lost prestige from that. It's also quite strategic in that it's a logistics hub and it sort of leads the way open to the city of Kharkiv. If they ever wanted to have another go at Kharkiv, the only road that they can really get there from that makes sense for them is through Kupiansk.
And you write about the situation being serious but not dire, that there is time to turn it around. If there is a big new push over the next few weeks, can the Ukrainians hold reasonably firm?
So in the piece that you're referencing, I basically give the example of what happened when we went out on this embed. It was with an artillery unit. It was, you know, but when they don't want us to say the exact, give two exact specifications. It was between 5 to 10 kilometers from Russian lines, is what I'll say. And what they said is basically about an hour before we arrived, they got a new delivery of shells. And what happened is that the Russians conducted an assault, not an offensive, like just a small sort of assault of the kind that they do, you know, every couple of days on a series of Ukrainian positions, you know, again, about, you know, 4 to 8 kilometers from us. And the gun that normally they say can only fire a couple of times a day, they just banged out about 10 to 12 shots right in front of us in about half an hour. It was actually, you know, it was quite cool to watch. And they sort of turned around to us and they were like, look, this is what we can do when we have all the shells. We stop them in their tracks. This is really the only thing that we need to keep going. We're not asking for, you know, other countries to send their troops to fight and die on this land. All we're asking is for these sort of, you know, is for more ammunition to be able to keep our guns firing.
And what about when you left? Did they have any shells left then?
Yeah, they did have shells left, but I mean, I remember having a little look in their storerooms, and they weren't exactly, you know, jam-packed full of stuff, if you know what I mean. They have to keep a small reserve on hand just in case something really serious or catastrophic does happen.
Do you think the whole future of the war hinges on that supply?
So, I mean, that is one of the major things it will depend on. So the most important weapons aid initiative the Ukrainians have received recently, by far, is not American or British or German. It's the Czech initiative, where the Czech Republic managed to go around and basically find, I think it was 1.3 or 1.4 million shells from various countries. We believe that some of them were Asian countries, some of them were African countries, who didn't necessarily want to sell their shells to Ukraine and thereby become what Russia would see as a party to the war, but didn't have so much of a problem selling them to a third-party intermediary like the Czech Republic. So that, and apparently the shells are already being delivered now, has been one of the major game changers. The other thing will probably be drones, just because, as I said before, drones are so effective in stopping, Russian advances. So, yeah, those two basic things. And it's interesting now that when you get there, so say back in 2022, a lot of what soldiers would say is it's like, oh, we need a no-fly zone over Ukraine. We need, you know, these huge, big-ticket weapons. Tell them to send us F-16s. Tell them to send us ATACMS or whatever. And now they've actually changed their tune. They're like, we need shells and we need drones. Mm. And that's the main thing. So they don't really ask as much, because one thing that, you know, every journalist basically knows is that often you go out with Ukrainian troops and they'll give you a bit of a shopping list of the things they need. Now it's not really those big-ticket items. It's much more it's much more just ammunition.
And you talked earlier about the Russians having people and vehicles in reserve. What about the Ukrainians?
So we're not really privy to those kind of things. We know that the Ukrainians have struggled to some extent with actually being able to rotate their troops. Now, I believe it has finally passed a mobilization law that's been going through Ukrainian parliament to allow the Ukrainian military to conscript younger men than it was able to conscript before, down to 25 from 27, in order to make up for some of the shortfall. Now, the Ukrainians will have, you know, soldiers and vehicles in reserve, but it's very unlikely that, at least at the moment, that they have enough in reserve to do anything more than counter the Russian advances themselves. They'll need much larger quantities, and they'll also need much better trained, trained soldiers if they're ever able to try and advance again like they did in 2022.
And what's next for you, Tom?
What's next for me is I'm thinking about going to the Zaporizhia region around Robotyne, which is where the Russians also might do a push. For your listeners, that's one of the small towns that Ukraine did manage to recapture in its otherwise relatively flat, unsuccessful counteroffensive of last year. The Russians are now trying to push that back and, you know, retake those Ukrainian gains from last year. But we'll see.
Tom, it's been really good speaking to you. Thank you so much for making the time, and hope to catch up with you again.
Not a problem, and thank you very much for having me on.
News, discussions, and analysis. This is SITREP.